I pulled my locker open. I hadn't done any homework. I was behind on everything. The hallway was so loud, so crowded. "Yeah," I said.
"No problem. I can do this all day. This is another reason we're destined to be together. You're so good at not talking. So, with Elena, she put gum in my hair on purpose while I was sleeping, and the next morning I was like, 'Why is there chewed gum in my hair?' And she was like, 'Ha ha.' I was like, 'Elena, you have no understanding of humor. It isn't funny just to make someone's life worse. Like, if I broke your leg, would that be funny?' And she was like, 'Ha ha.' So I got this fancy haircut, and believe you me, I paid for it out of Elena's college fund. My parents made me set up a college fund for Elena, BTW. In other news, the whole Michael thing has made our lunch table a little awkward, so we're going to have a two-person picnic outside. I know it's slightly cold, but trust me, sitting next to Michael in the cafeteria is far colder. Are you so ready to go to biology right now and just absolutely murder it? Like, in 47 minutes, the dead and bloodless carcass of honors biology will be laid before your feet. God, a lot happened since you lost your mind. Is that rude to say?"
"Actually, the problem is that I can't lose my mind," I said. "It's inescapable."
"That is precisely how I feel about my virginity," Daisy said. "Another reason Michael and I were doomed. He doesn't want to have sex unless he's in love. And yes, I know that virginity is a misogynistic and oppressive social construct, but I still want to lose it. And meanwhile, I've got this boy hemming and hawing like we're in a Jane Austen novel. I wish boys didn't have all these feelings I have to manage like a fucking psychiatrist." Daisy walked me to the door of my classroom, opened it, and then walked me to my desk. I sat down. "You know I love you, right?"
I nodded.
"My whole life I thought I was the star of an overly earnest romance movie, and it turns out I was in a goddamned buddy comedy all along. I gotta go to Kelk. Good to see you, Holmesy."
Daisy had brought leftover pizza for our picnic, and we sat underneath our school's one big oak tree, halfway to the football field. It was frigid, and both of us were bundled into our winter coats, hoods up, my jeans stiff on the frozen ground. I didn't have gloves, so I tucked my fists into the coat. It was no weather for a picnic.
"I've been thinking a lot about Pickett," Daisy said.
"Yeah?"
"Yeah, just, while you were gone, I kept thinking about how weird it is to leave your kids like that, without even saying goodbye. I almost feel bad for him, to be honest. Like, what has to be wrong with him that he doesn't at least buy a burner phone somewhere and text his kids and tell them he's okay?"
I felt worse for the 13-year-old who wakes up every morning thinking that maybe today is the day, and then he plays video games every night to distract from the dull ache of knowing your father doesn't trust or love you enough to be in contact. Your father who privileged a Tuatara over you in his estate plans.
"I feel worse for Noah than for Pickett," I said.
"You've always empathized with that kid," she said. "Even when you can't with your best friend."
I shot her a glance and she laughed it off, but I knew she wasn't kidding.
"So, what do your parents do?" I asked.
Daisy laughed again.
"My dad works at the State Museum. He's a security guard there. He likes it because he's really into Indiana history, but mostly he just makes sure nobody touches the mastodon bones or whatever. My mom works at a dry cleaner's in Broad Ripple."
"Have you told them about the money yet?"
"Yeah, that's how Elena got that college fund. They made me put 10 grand in it. My dad was like,
'Elena would do the same for you if she came into some money.'
Like hell she would."
"They weren't mad?"
"That I came home one day with $50,000? No, Holmesy. They weren't mad."
Inside the arm of my coat, I could feel something seeping from my middle fingertip. I'd have to change the Band-Aid before history, have to go through the whole annoying ritual of it. But for now, I liked being next to Daisy. I liked watching my warm breath in the cold.
"How's Davis?" she asked.
"Haven't talked to him," I said. "I haven't talked to anyone."
"So it was pretty bad?"
"Yeah," I said.
"I'm sorry."
"Yeah, it's not your fault."
Do you think about killing yourself?"
"I thought about not wanting to be that way anymore."
Are you still?
I don't know.
I let out a long, slow breath and watched the steam of it disappear in the winter air. I think maybe I'm like the White River. Non-navigable.
But that's not the point of the story, Holmesy. The point of the story is they built the city anyway, you know? You work with what you have. They had this shit river, and they managed to build an okay city around it. Not a great city, maybe, but not bad. You're not the river. You're the city.
So I'm not bad?
Correct. You're a solid B+. If you can build a B+ city with C- geography, that's pretty great.
I laughed. Beside me, Daisy lay down and motioned for me to lie next to her. We were looking up, our heads near the trunk of that lone oak tree. The sky smoke gray above us past our fogged breath. The leafless branches intersecting overhead.
I don't know if I'd ever told Daisy about that.
If she lay down at precisely that moment because she knew how much I loved seeing the sky cut up. I thought about how branches far from one another could still intersect in my line of vision. Like how the stars of Cassiopeia were far from one another, but somehow near to me.
I wish I understood it, she said. It's okay, I said.
Nobody gets anybody else. Not really. We're all stuck inside ourselves.
You just, like, hate yourself? You hate being yourself?
There's no self to hate.
It's like when I look into myself, there's no actual me. Just a bunch of thoughts and behaviors and circumstances, and a lot of them just don't feel like they're mine. They're not things I want to think or do or whatever. And when I look for the, like, real me, I never find it. It's like those nesting dolls, you know? The ones that are hollow, and then when you open them up, there's a smaller doll inside, and you keep opening hollow dolls until eventually you get to the smallest one, and it's solid all the way through. But with me, I don't think there is one that's solid. They just keep getting smaller.
That reminds me of a story my mom tells, Daisy said.
What story?
I could hear her teeth chattering when she talked, but neither of us wanted to stop looking up at the latticed sky.
Okay, so there's this scientist, and he's giving a lecture to a huge audience about the history of the Earth, and he explains that the Earth was formed billions of years ago from a cloud of cosmic dust, and then for a while the Earth was very hot, but then it cooled enough for oceans to form, and single-celled life emerged in the oceans, and then over billions of years, life got more abundant and complex, until 250,000 or so years ago, humans evolved. And we started using more advanced tools, and then eventually built spaceships and everything. So he gives this whole presentation about the history of Earth and life on it, and then at the end, he asks if there are any questions. An old woman in the back raises her hand and says,
That's all fine and good, Mr. Scientist, but the truth is, the Earth is a flat plane resting on the back of a giant turtle.
The scientist decides to have a bit of fun with the woman and responds,
Well, but if that's so, what is the giant turtle standing upon? And the woman says, It is standing upon the shell of another giant turtle.
And now the scientist is frustrated, and he says,
Well, then what is that turtle standing upon? And the old woman says, Sir, you don't understand. It's turtles all the way down.
I laughed. It's turtles all the way down. It's turtles all the way fucking down, Holmesy. You're trying to find the turtle at the bottom of the pile, but that's not how it works.
Because it's turtles all the way down. I said again, feeling something akin to a spiritual revelation.
I stopped at Mom's classroom for the last few minutes of lunch. I closed the door behind me and sat down at a desk opposite her. I glanced up at the clock on the wall. 1:08. I had 6 minutes. I didn't want more.
Hey, I said. First day back going well?
She blew her nose into a Kleenex. She had a cold, but she'd spent all her sick days on me being sick.
Yeah,
I said. So listen, Davis gave me some money. A lot of money. About $50,000. I haven't spent it or anything. I'm saving it for college.
Her face tightened.
It was a gift, I said again.
When?
She asked.
A couple months ago.
That's not a gift.
A necklace is a gift. $50,000 is not a gift.
If I were you, I'd return that money to Davis, she said. You don't want to feel indebted to him.
But I'm not you, I said. And I don't.
After a second, she said,
That's true. You're not.
I waited for her to say something more, to tell me why I was wrong to keep the money. At last, she said,
Your life is yours, Aza. But I think if you look at your mental health the last couple months,
the money didn't cause that. I've been sick for a long time.
Not like this. I need you to be well, Aza. I can't lose.
God, Mom, please stop saying that. I know you're not trying to make me feel pressure, but it feels like I'm hurting you. Like I'm committing assault or something, and it makes me feel 10,000 times worse. I'm doing my best, but I can't stay sane for you, okay?
After a minute, she said, The day you came home after the accident, I carried you to the bathroom, and I carried you back to bed and tucked the covers up to your chin, and I realized that I'll probably never pick you up again.
You're right. I keep saying I can't lose you, but I will. I am. And that's a hard thought. That's a hard, hard thought. But you're right. You're not me. You make your own choices. And if you're saving it for your education, making responsible decisions, well, then I'm...
She never finished the sentence because the bell beeped from on high.
Okay, I said.
Love you, Aza.
I love you too, Mom.
I wanted to say more, to find a way to express the magnetic poles of my love for my mother. Thank you, I'm sorry, thank you, I'm sorry, but I couldn't bring myself to, and anyway, the bell had rung.
Before I could get to history, Michael intercepted me.
Hey, how's it going?
He asked. I'm okay, you?
Daisy and I broke up.
I heard.
I'm kinda devastated.
Sorry.
And she isn't even upset about it, which just makes me feel pathetic. She thinks I should get over it. But everything reminds me of her, Holmesy. And seeing her ignore me, not show up to lunch, all that. Can you, talk to her for me?
Right then, I spotted Daisy halfway down the crowded hallway, her head down.
Daisy!
I shouted. She kept walking, so I yelled again, louder. She looked up and picked her way toward us through the crowd. I pulled her and Michael together.
Both of you can talk to me about each other, but you can't talk to each other about each other, and you're going to fix that because it's annoying. Cool? Cool. I have to go to history.
Daisy texted me during class.
Thanks for that. We've decided to just be friends.
Me.
Cool.
Her.
But the kind of friends who kiss right after deciding to just be friends.
Me.
I'm sure this will work out perfectly.
Her.
Everything always does.
Since I had my phone out and we were watching a video in class anyway, I decided to text Davis.
Sorry not to reply for so long.
Hi.
I miss you.
He wrote back immediately.
When can I see you?
Me.
Tomorrow?
Him.
7 at Applebee's?
Me.
Sounds good.
22. I thought I'd be fine driving Mom's silver Toyota Camry to Applebee's that night, but I couldn't shake memories of the accident. It seemed surreal and miraculous to me that so many cars could drive past one another without colliding, and I felt certain that each set of headlights headed my way would inevitably veer into my path. Remembered the crunching sound of Harold's death, the silence that followed, the agony in my ribs, thought about the biggest part being the part that hurts, about my dad's phone gone forever. Tried to let myself have the thoughts, because to deny them was to just let them take over. It sort of worked, like everything else. I made it to Applebee's 15 minutes early. Davis was already there, and he hugged me in the entryway before we got seated. A thought appeared in my mind, undeniable as the sun in a clear sky. He's going to want to put his bacteria in your mouth. Hi, I said.
I missed you,
he said. After the nervous-making car trip, my brain was revving up. I told myself that having a thought was not dangerous, that thoughts aren't actions, that thoughts are just thoughts. Dr. Karen Singh liked to say that an unwanted thought was like a car driving past you when you're standing on the side of the road. And I told myself I didn't have to get into that car. That my moment of choice was not whether to have the thought, but whether to be carried away by it. And then I got in the car. I sat down in the booth, and instead of sitting across from me, he sat next to me, his hip against mine.
I talked to your mom a few times, he said. I think she's coming around to me.
Who cares if he wants his bacteria in my mouth? Kissing is nice. Kissing feels good. I want to kiss him.
But you don't want to get Campylobacter.
I won't. You'll be sick for weeks. Might have to take antibiotics. Stop. Then you'll get C. diff, or you'll get Epstein-Barr from the Campylobacter. Stop. That could paralyze you. All because you kissed him when you didn't even actually want to, because it's fucking gross, inserting your tongue into someone else's mouth.
Are you there?
He asked.
What?
Yeah, I said.
I asked how you're feeling.
Good, I said. Honestly, not good right now, but good in general.
Why not good right now?
Can you sit across from me?
Yeah, of course.
He got up and moved around to the opposite bench, which made me feel better. For a moment, anyway. I can't do this, I said.
Can't do what?
This, I said. I can't, Davis. I don't know if I'll ever be able to. Like, I know you're waiting for me to get better, and I really appreciate all your texts and everything. It's incredibly sweet. But, like, this is probably what better looks like for me.
I like this you.
No, you don't. You want to make out and sit on the same side of the table and do other normal couple things, because of course you do. He didn't say anything for a minute.
Maybe you just don't find me attractive?
It's not that, I said.
But maybe it is.
It's not. It's not that I don't want to kiss you or that I don't like kissing or whatever. My brain says that kissing is one of a bunch of things that will, like, kill me. Like, actually kill me. But it's not even about dying, really. Like, if I knew I was dying and I kissed you goodbye, literally my last thought wouldn't be about the fact that I was dying. It would be about the 80 million microbes that we'd just exchanged. I know that when you just touched me, it didn't give me a disease, or it probably didn't. God, I can't even say that it definitely didn't, because I'm so fucking scared of it. I can't even call it anything but it, you know? I just can't. I could tell I was hurting him. I could see it in the way he kept blinking. I could see that he didn't understand it. That he couldn't. I didn't blame him. It made no sense. I was a story riddled with plot holes.
That sounds really scary,
he said. I just nodded.
Do you feel like you're getting better?
Everyone wanted me to feed them that story. Darkness to light, weakness to strength, broken to whole. I wanted it too.
Maybe, I said. Honestly, I feel really fragile. I feel like I've been taped back together.
I know that feeling.
How are you? I asked.
He shrugged.
How's Noah? I asked.
Not good.
Unpack that for me, I said.
He just misses Dad. It's like Noah's two people, almost. There's the miniature dude bro who drinks bad vodka and is the king of his little gang of eighth-grade pseudo-badasses, and then the kid who crawls into bed with me some nights and cries. It's almost like Noah thinks if he screws up enough, Dad will be forced to come out of hiding.
He's heartbroken, I said.
Yeah, well, aren't we all? I don't really want to talk about my life, if that's okay.
It occurred to me that Davis probably liked what infuriated Daisy, that I didn't ask too many questions. Everyone else was so relentlessly curious about the life of the billionaire boy, but I'd always been too stuck inside myself to interrogate him. Slowly, the conversation sputtered. We started talking to each other like people who used to be close, catching each other up on our lives rather than living them together. By the time he paid the bill, I knew that whatever we'd been, we weren't anymore. Still, once I was home and under the covers, I texted him.
You around?
You can't do it the other way,
he replied.
And I can't do it this way.
Me? Why?
Him.
It makes me feel like you only like me at a distance. I need to be liked close up.
I kept typing and deleting, typing and deleting. I never ended up replying. The next day at school, I was walking across the cafeteria to our lunch table when I was intercepted by Daisy.
Holmesy, we have to talk privately.
She sat me down at a mostly empty lunch table, a few seats away from some freshmen.
Did you break up with Michael again?
No, of course not. The magic of being just friends is that you can't break up. I feel like I've unlocked the secret of the universe with this just friends thing, but no.
We're going on an adventure.
We are?
Do you feel like you've recovered your wits enough that you could, for instance, sneak underneath the city of Indianapolis to attend a guerrilla art show?
A what?
Okay, so remember how I had that idea for Michael to make those photographic montages of exonerated prisoners?
Well, it was mostly his Let's not get lost in the details, Holmesy. The point is he made it and submitted it to this super cool arts collective, Known City, and they are putting it in this one-night-only gallery show they're doing Friday night called Underground Art, where they turn part of the Pogues Run Tunnel into an art gallery.
Pogues Run was the tunnel that emptied into the White River that Pickett's company had been hired to expand. The work they'd never finished. Seemed an odd place for an art show.
I don't really want to spend Friday night at an illegal art gallery.
It's not illegal. They have permission. It's just super underground, like literally underground.
I scrunched up my face.
It's like the coolest thing ever to happen in Indianapolis, and my just friend has art in the show.
Obviously, don't feel obligated to be there, but do be there.
I don't want to be a third wheel. I am going to be nervous and surrounded by people cooler than me, and I'd really like my best friend to be there.
I opened the Ziploc bag containing my peanut butter and honey sandwich and took a bite.
You're thinking about it, she said, excitement in her voice.
I'm thinking about it, I allowed.
And then, after I swallowed, I said, All right, let's do it.
Yes, yes, we will pick you up at 6:15 on Friday. It's going to be amazing.
The way she smiled at me made it impossible not to smile back. In a quiet voice, not even sure she could hear me, I said, I love you, Daisy. I know you say that to me all the time, and I never say it, but I do. I love you.
Ah, fuck. Don't go all soft on me, Holmesy.
Michael and Daisy showed up at my doorstep at 6:15 sharp. She was wearing a dress and tights combo dwarfed by her huge puffer coat, and Michael was wearing a silver-gray suit that was slightly too big for him. I had on a long-sleeve t-shirt, jeans, and a coat.
I didn't know I was supposed to dress up for the sewer, I said sheepishly.
The art sewer, Daisy smiled. I wondered whether maybe I should change, but she just grabbed me and said, Holmesy, you look radiant. You look like yourself.
I sat in one of the back seats in Michael's minivan, and as he drove south on Michigan Road, Daisy started playing one of our favorite songs, You're the One. Michael was laughing as Daisy and I screamed the lyrics to each other. She sang lead, and I belted out the background voice that just repeated, You're everything, everything, everything. And I felt like I was. You're both the fire and the water that extinguishes it. You're the narrator, the protagonist, and the sidekick. You're the storyteller and the story told. You are somebody's something. But you are also your you. As Daisy switched the song to a romantic ballad that she and Michael were singing, I started thinking about Turtles All the Way Down. I was thinking that maybe the old lady and the scientist were both right. Like, the world is billions of years old. And life is a product of nucleotide mutation and everything. But the world is also the stories we tell about it. Michael turned off Michigan at 10th Street. And we drove for a while until we reached a pool supply store with a flickering backlit sign saying Rosenthal Pools. The parking lot was already half full. Daisy stopped the music as Michael pulled into a spot. We got out and found ourselves surrounded by a weird mix of 20-something hipsters and middle-aged couples. Everyone but us seemed to know one another, and the three of us stood next to Michael's car for a long time in silence, just watching the scene, until a middle-aged woman in an all-black outfit walked over and said, Are you here for the event?
I'm, Michael Turner, Michael said. I have a picture in the show.
Prisoner 101?
Yeah, that's me.
I'm Francis Oliver. I think Prisoner 101 is one of the strongest pieces in the gallery, and I'm the curator, so I should know. Come, come, let's head on down together. I would be fascinated to learn more about your process.
Francis and Michael began walking across the parking lot, but every few seconds Francis would pause and say, Oh, I must introduce you two, and we'd stop for a while to meet an artist or a collector or a funding partner. Slowly, he was swallowed by all the people who loved Prisoner 101 and wanted to talk with him about it. And after we stood behind him for a while, Daisy finally grabbed him by the hand and said, We're going to head down to the show. Enjoy this. I'm so proud of you.
I can come with,
he said, turning away from a gaggle of art students from Heron, the art college in town.
No, have fun. You got to meet all these people so they'll buy your pictures.
He smiled, kissed her, and returned to his crowd of fans. When Daisy and I reached the edge of the parking lot, we saw through the trees a flashlight waving back and forth in the air. So we wound our way down a little hill toward the light until the brush opened up into a wide concrete basin. A tiny stream of water, I could easily step over it, bubbled along its bottom. We walked toward the bearded man waving the flashlight, who introduced himself as Kip and handed us hard hats with lanterns and a flashlight.
Follow the tunnel in for 200 yards. Then take your first left, and you'll be in the gallery.
The light from my helmet followed the creek downstream. In the distance, I could see the start of the tunnel, a light-sucking square cut into a hillside. There was an overturned shopping cart just outside the start of the culvert, trapped against a moss-covered boulder. As we walked toward the tunnel's entrance, I looked up at the black silhouettes of leafless maple trees splitting up the sky. The creek ran along the left side of the Pogues Run Tunnel. We walked on a slightly elevated concrete sidewalk to the right of the creek. The smell enveloped us immediately. Sewage, and the sickly sweet smell of rot. I thought my nose would get used to it, but it never did. A few steps in, we began to hear rodents scurrying along the creek bed. We could hear voices, too. Echoey, unintelligible conversations that seemed to be coming from all sides of us. Our headlamps lit up the graffiti that lined the walls. Spray-painted tags in bubble letters, but also stenciled images and messages. Daisy's light lingered on one image, featuring a portly rat drinking a bottle of wine with the caption, "The Rat King Knows Your Secrets." Another message, scrawled in what looked like white house paint, read, "It's not how you die, it's who you die." "This is a little creepy," Daisy whispered.
"Why are you whispering?"
"Scared," she whispered. "Has it been 200 yards yet?"
"Dunno," I said. "But I hear people up there."
I turned around and shone my light back toward the tunnel's entrance, and a couple of middle-aged men behind us waved. "See, it's fine." The creek wasn't really a body of water anymore, so much as a slow-moving puddle. I watched a rat scamper across it without ever getting its nose wet.
"That was a rat,"
Daisy said, her voice clenched. "It lives here," I said. "We're the invaders." We kept walking. The only light in the world seemed to be the yellow beams of headlamps and flashlights. It was almost like everyone down there had become beams of light, bouncing along the tunnel in little groups. Ahead of us, I saw headlamps turning to the left into a square side tunnel about 8 feet high. We jumped over the trickling creek, past a sign that read, "A Picket Engineering Project," and into the concrete side tunnel. You could only see the artwork by the light of headlamps and flashlights, so the paintings and photographs lining the walls seemed to come in and out of focus. To see all of Michael's picture, you had to stand against the opposite wall of the tunnel. It really was an amazing artwork. Prisoner 101 looked as real as anyone. But he was made from pieces of the 100 mugshots Michael had found of men convicted of murder and then exonerated. Even up close, I couldn't tell that Prisoner 101 wasn't real. The rest of the art was cool, too. Big abstract paintings of hard-edged geometric shapes, an assemblage of old wooden chairs precariously stacked to the ceiling. A huge photograph of a kid, jumping on a trampoline alone in a vast harvested cornfield. But Michael's was my favorite, and not just because I knew him. After a while, we heard a clamor of voices approach, and the gallery became crowded. Someone had set up a stereo, and music began reverberating through the tunnel. Plastic cups were passed around, and then bottles of wine, and the place got louder and louder, and even though it was freezing down there, I started to feel sweaty. So I asked Daisy if she wanted to go for a walk.
"A walk?"
"Yeah, just, I don't know, down the tunnel or something."
"You want to go for a walk down the tunnel?"
"Yeah, I mean, we don't have to." She pointed into the darkness beyond the reach of our headlamps.
"You're proposing that we just walk into that void?"
"Not for like a mile or anything. Just to see what there is to see." Daisy sighed.
"Yeah, okay, let's go for a walk."
It only took a minute for the air to feel crisper. The tunnel ahead of us was pitch black, and it curved in a long, slow arc away from the party until we couldn't see the light from it anymore. We could still hear the music and the people talking over it, but it felt distant, like a party you drive past.
"I don't understand how you can be so inhumanly calm down here, 15 feet below downtown Indianapolis, ankle-deep in rat shit, but you have a panic attack when you think your finger is infected."
"I don't know," I said. "This just isn't scary."
"It objectively is," she said.
I reached up and clicked off my headlamp. "Turn off your light," I said.
"Hell no!"
Turn it off. Nothing bad will happen.
She clicked off her light and the world went dark. I felt my eyes trying to adjust, but there was no light to adjust to.
Now you can't see the walls, right?
Can't see the rats.
Spin around a few times, and you won't know which way is in and which way is out. This is scary.
Now imagine if we couldn't talk, if we couldn't hear each other's breathing. Imagine if we had no sense of touch, so even if we were standing next to each other, we'd never know it.
Imagine you're trying to find someone, or even you're trying to find yourself, but you have no senses. No way to know where the walls are. Which way is forward or backward? What is water and what is air?
You're senseless and shapeless. You feel like you can only describe what you are by identifying what you're not, and you're floating around in a body with no control.
You don't get to decide who you like, or where you live, or when you eat, or what you fear. You're just stuck in there, totally alone, in this darkness. That's scary.
This, I said, and turned on the flashlight.
This is control.
This is power. There may be rats and spiders and whatever the hell, but we shine the light on them, not the other way around. We know where the walls are, which way is in and which way is out.
This, I said, turning off my light again, is what I feel like when I'm scared.
This, I turned the flashlight back on,
is a walk in the fucking park.
We walked for a while in silence.
It's that bad? She asked finally.
Sometimes, I said.
But then your flashlight starts working again, she said.
So far.
As we kept walking through the tunnel, the music behind us growing fainter, Daisy calmed down a bit.
I'm thinking of killing off Ayala, she said. Would you take that personally?
Nah, I said. I was just starting to like her, though.
Did you read the most recent one?
The one where they go to Ryloth to deliver power converters?
I loved the scene where Rey and Ayala are waiting for that dude in a bar, and they're just talking.
I like your action scenes and everything, but the just talking is my favorite.
Also, I liked that I got to hook up with a Twi'lek. Or Ayala did, I guess.
Your writing makes me feel like it's real, like I'm really there.
Thanks, she said. Now you're making me think maybe I shouldn't kill her.
I don't mind if you kill her, just make her die a hero.
Oh, of course, she has to. I was thinking I'd make it some Rogue One-style sacrifice for the common good, if that sounds okay.
Works for me, I told her.
God, is the smell getting worse? She asked.
It's not getting better, I acknowledged.
It smelled more like rotting garbage and unflushed toilets, and as we passed an offshoot to the tunnel, Daisy said she wanted to turn around. But in the distance ahead of us, I could see a pinprick of gray light, and I wanted to see what was at the end. As we walked, the sounds of the city grew slowly louder, and the smell improved because we were close to open air. The gray light grew larger until we reached the edge of the tunnel. It was open and unfinished. The tiny trickle of water that was supposed to be diverted from the White River was instead dripping down into it, two stories below us. I looked up. It was past 10 o'clock, but I'd never seen the city look so blindingly bright. I could see everything. The green moss on the boulders in the river below, the golden frothy bubbles at the base of the waterfall, the trees in the distance bent over the water like the roof of a chapel. The power lines sagging across the river below us, a great silver grain mill, absurdly still in the moonlight. Neon speedway and Chase Bank signs in the distance.
Indianapolis is so flat you can never really look down on it. It's not a town with million-dollar views. But now I had one. In the most unexpected place, the city stretching out below and beyond me, and it took a minute before I remembered that this was nighttime, that this silver-lit landscape is what passed above ground for darkness. Daisy surprised me by sitting down,
her legs dangling over the concrete edge. I sat down on the other side of the trickle of water, and we looked at the same scene together for a long time. We went out to the meadow that night, talking about college and kissing and religion and art, and I didn't feel like I was watching a movie of our conversation. I was having it. I could listen to her, and I knew she was listening to me.
"I wonder if they'll ever finish this thing," Daisy said at one point.
"I kind of hope not," I said. "I mean, I'm all for clean water, but I kind of want to be able to come here again in like 10 or 20 years or something. Like, instead of going to my high school reunion, I want to be here."
"With you," I wanted to say.
"Yeah," she said. "Keep Pogue's Run filthy, because the view from the unfinished water treatment tunnel is spectacular. Thanks, Russell Pickett, for your corruption and incompetence."
"Pogue's Run," I mumbled.
"Wait, where does Pogue's Run start? Where is its mouth?" "The mouth of a river is where it ends, not where it begins. This is the mouth."
I watched her realize it.
"Pogue's Run. Holy shit, Holmesy. We're in the jogger's mouth."
I stood up. I felt for some reason like Pickett might be right behind us, like he might push us off the edge of his tunnel and into the river below.
"Now I'm a little freaked out," I said. "What are we gonna do?"
"Nothing," I said. "Nothing. We're gonna turn around, walk back to the party, hang out with fancy art people, and get home by curfew." I started walking back toward the distant music. "I'll tell Davis so he knows. We let him decide whether to tell Noah. Other than that, we don't say a word."
"All right," she said, hustling to catch up to me. "I mean, is he down here right now?"
"I don't know," I said. "I don't think it's for us to know."
"Right," she said. "How could he have been down here this whole time, though?"
I had a guess, but didn't say anything.
"God, that smell," she said, her voice trailing off as she said it. You'd think solving mysteries would bring you closure, that closing the loop would comfort and quiet your mind, but it never does. The truth always disappoints. As we circulated around the gallery looking for Michael, I didn't feel like I'd found the solid nesting doll or anything. Nothing had been fixed, not really. It was like the zoologist said about science, you never really find answers, just new and deeper questions. We finally found Michael leaning against the wall opposite his photograph, talking to two older women. Daisy cut in and took his hand. "I hate to break up this party," she said, "but this famous artist has a curfew."
Michael laughed, and the three of us made our way out of the tunnel, into the silver-bright parking lot, and then into Michael's minivan. The moment my door slid shut, he said,
"That was the best night of my life. Thank you for being there. Oh, my God, that was just the best thing that's ever happened to me. I feel like I might be an artist, like a proper one. That was so, so amazing. Did you guys have fun?"
"Tell us all about it," Daisy said, not exactly answering his question.
When I got home, Mom was sitting at the kitchen table drinking a mug of tea.
"What is that smell?" she asked.
"Sewage, body odor, mold, a mix of things."
"I'm worried, Aza. I'm worried you're losing your connection to reality."
"I'm not," I said. "I'm just tired."
"Tonight you're gonna stay up and talk to me."
"About what?"
"About where you were, what you were doing, who you were doing it with, about your life."
So I told her. I told her that Daisy and Michael and I had attended a one-night art show beneath downtown, and that Daisy and I had walked to the end of Pickett's unfinished tunnel. And I told her about going out to the meadow. And I told her about the jogger's mouth, about thinking Pickett was maybe down there, about the stench.
"You're going to tell Davis?" she asked.
"Yeah."
But not the police?
No, I said. If I tell the police and he is dead down there, Davis and Noah's house won't even be theirs anymore. It'll be owned by a Tuatara.
A Tuawada?
A Tuatara. It looks like a lizard, but it isn't a lizard. Descended from the dinosaurs. They lived for like 150 years, and Pickett's will leaves everything to his pet Tuatara. The house, the business, everything.
The madness of wealth, my mother mumbled. Sometimes you think you're spending money, but all along the money's spending you.
She glanced down at her cup of tea and then back up to me.
But only if you worship it. You serve whatever you worship.
So we gotta be careful what we worship, I said. She smiled, then shooed me off to the shower. As I stood underneath the water, I wondered what I'd worship as I got older, and how that would end up bending the arc of my life this way or that. I was still at the beginning. I could still be anybody. 23. I woke up the next morning, a Saturday, feeling truly rested, frozen rain plinking against my bedroom window. Indianapolis winters rarely feature the sort of beautiful snow that you can ski and sled in. Our usual winter precipitation is a conglomeration called wintry mix, involving ice pellets, frozen rain, and wind. It wasn't even that cold, maybe 35, but the wind was howling outside. I got up, dressed, ate some cereal, took a pill, and watched a bit of TV with Mom. I spent the morning procrastinating. I'd pull out my phone, start to text him, and then put it away. Then pull it out again, but no, not yet. It never seemed like the right time. But of course, it never is the right time. I remember after my dad died, for a while, it was both true and not true in my mind. For weeks, really, I could conjure him into being. I'd imagine him walking in, soaked in sweat, having finished mowing the lawn, and he'd try to hug me, but I'd squirm out from his arms because even then sweat freaked me out. Or I'd be in my room, lying on my stomach reading a book, and I'd look over at the closed door and imagine him opening it. And then he would be in the room with me, and I'd be looking up at him as he knelt down to kiss the top of my head. And then it became harder to summon him, to smell his smell, to feel him lifting me up. My father died suddenly, but also across the years. He was still dying, really. Which meant, I guess, that he was still living, too. People always talk like there's a bright line between imagination and memory, but there isn't, at least not for me. I remember what I've imagined, and imagine what I remember. I finally texted Davis just after noon. We need to talk. Can you come over to my house today? He replied,
Nobody's here to look after Noah. Can you come over here?
I need to talk to you alone, I wrote. I wanted Davis to have the choice whether or not to tell his brother.
I can be there at 5:30.
Thanks. See you then. The day moved agonizingly slowly. I tried reading, texting Daisy, and watching TV, but nothing would make the time speed up. I wasn't sure whether life would be better frozen in this moment or on the other side of the moment that was coming. By 4:45, I was reading in the living room while Mom paid bills. Davis is coming over in a little bit, I told her.
Okay, I've got a couple errands to run. You need anything at the grocery store?
I shook my head.
You feeling anxious?
Is there any way we can make a deal where I tell you when I have a mental health concern instead of you asking?
It's impossible for me not to worry, baby.
I know, but it's also impossible not to feel the weight of that worry like a boulder on my chest.
I'll try.
Thanks, Mom. I love you.
I love you, too. So much.
I scrolled through my endless TV options, none of them particularly compelling, until I heard Davis's knock, soft and unsteady, on the door.
"Hey,"
I said and hugged him.
"Hey,"
he said. I motioned to the couch for him to sit down.
"How've you been?"
"Listen," I said. "Davis, your dad, I know where the jogger's mouth is. It's the mouth of Pogue's Run where the company had that unfinished project." He winced, then nodded.
"You're sure?"
"Pretty sure," I said. "I think he might be down there. Daisy and I were there last night, and..."
"Did you see him?"
I shook my head. "No. But the Run's mouth, the jogger's mouth, it makes sense."
"It's just a note from his phone, though. You think he's just been down there this whole time, hiding in a sewer?"
"Maybe," I said. "But, well, I don't know."
"But?"
"I don't want to worry you, but there was a bad smell, a really bad smell down there."
"That could have been anything,"
he said, but I could see the fear on his face. "I know, yeah, totally, it could be anything."
"I never thought. I never let myself think."
And then his voice caught. The cry that finally came out of him felt like the sky ripping open. He sort of fell into me, and I held him on the couch, felt his rib cage heave. It wasn't only Noah who missed his father.
"Oh, God. He's dead, isn't he?"
"You don't know that," I said. But he kind of did. There was a reason there had been no trail and no communication. He'd been gone all along. He lay down and I lay down with him, the two of us barely fitting on the musty couch. He kept saying, "What do I do? What do I do?" His head on my shoulder. I wondered whether it was a mistake to tell him.
"What do I do?"
He asked it again and again, pleading.
"You keep going," I told him. "You've got 7 years. No matter what actually happened, he'll be legally alive for 7 years, and you'll have the house and everything. That's a long time to build a new life, Davis. 7 years ago, you and I hadn't even met, you know?"
"We've got nobody now,"
he mumbled. I wished I could tell him that he had me, that he could count on me. But he couldn't.
"You have your brother," I said.
That made him split open again, and we cuddled together for a long time until Mom came home with the groceries. Davis and I both jumped to a seating position, even though we hadn't been doing anything.
"Sorry to interrupt," Mom said.
"I was just headed out,"
Davis said.
"You don't have to,"
Mom and I said simultaneously.
"I kinda do,"
he said. He leaned over and hugged me with one arm.
"Thank you,"
he whispered, although I wasn't sure I'd done him any favors. Davis stopped at the doorway for a second, looked back at Mom and me in what must have seemed to him like domestic bliss. I thought he might say something, but he just waved shyly and awkwardly and disappeared out the front door. It was a quiet night in the Holmes household. Could have been any night, really. I worked on a paper about the Civil War for history class. Outside, the day, which had never been particularly bright, dissolved into darkness. I told Mom I was going to sleep, changed into pajamas, brushed my teeth, changed the Band-Aid over the scab on my fingertip, crawled into bed, and texted Davis.
"Hi."
When he didn't reply, I wrote Daisy.
"Talked to Davis."
Her.
"How'd it go?"
Me. "Not great." Her.
"Want me to come over?"
Me.
"Yeah."
Her.
"On my way."
An hour later, Daisy and I were lying next to each other on my bed. Computers on our stomachs.
I was reading the new Ayala story.
Every time I giggled at something, she'd say, "What's funny?" And I'd tell her.
After I finished it, we just lay there in bed together, staring up at the ceiling.
"Well," Daisy said after a while, "it all worked out in the end."
"How's that?"
"Our heroes got rich and nobody got hurt."
"Everyone got hurt," I pointed out.
"What I mean is that no one got injured.
I lacerated my liver."
"Oh, right, I forgot about that. At least no one died." "Harold died! And possibly Pickett." "Holmesy, I am trying to have a happy ending here. Stop screwing it up for me."
"I'm so Ayala," I answered.
"So Ayala."
"The problem with happy endings," I said, "is that they're either not really happy or not really endings, you know? In real life, some things get better and some things get worse, and then eventually you die."
Daisy laughed. "As always, Aza, and then eventually you die, Holmes, is here to remind you of how the story really ends with the extinction of our species."
I laughed.
"Well, that is the only real ending, though."
"No, it's not, Holmesy. You pick your endings and your beginnings. You get to pick the frame, you know?
Maybe you don't choose what's in the picture, but you decide on the frame."
Davis never wrote me back, not even after I texted him a few days later. But he did update his blog. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And, like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. William Shakespeare.
I get that nothing lasts, but why do I have to miss everybody so much?
24. A month later, just after Christmas vacation ended, I got up early and poured a couple bowls of cereal for Mom and me. I was eating in front of the TV when she walked in, still wearing pajamas, flustered.
"Late, late, late," she said. "Hit snooze too many times."
"I made you breakfast," I told her. And when she joined me on the couch, she said,
"Cheerios aren't something you make."
I laughed as she took a few bites, then ran off to get dressed. Always a flurry of movement, my mother. When I turned back to the TV, a red breaking news band was scrolling across the bottom of the screen. I saw a reporter standing in front of the gates of the Pickett compound. I fumbled for the remote and unmuted the TV.
"Our sources indicate that while Pickett has not been positively identified, authorities believe the body found in an offshoot of the Pogues Run Tunnel is indeed that of billionaire construction magnate Russell Davis Pickett Sr. One source close to the investigation told Eyewitness News that Pickett likely died of exposure within, quote, a few days of his disappearance. And while we have no official confirmation, several sources tell us that Pickett's body was discovered by police after an anonymous tip."
I texted Davis immediately.
"Just saw the news. I'm so sorry, Davis. I know I've said that to you a lot, but I am. I'm just so sorry."
He didn't reply right away, so I added, "I want you to know it wasn't Daisy or me who tipped off the cops. We never said anything to anyone." Now I saw the dot, dot, dot of his typing.
"I know. It was us. Noah and I decided together."
Mom came in, putting earrings in while slipping on her shoes. She must have overheard the last bit of the story, because she said,
"Aza, you should reach out to Davis. This is going to be a very hard day for him."
"I was just texting him," I said. "They were the ones who told the cops where to look."
"Can you imagine? That whole estate is going to a lizard?"
"They could have waited 7 years, at least, before Pickett was declared dead. 7 more years of that house,
7 more years of getting anything they wanted.